You're listening to the Body Pros podcast coverage of IAS 2009, the 5th International AIDS Society Conference on HIV Pathogenesis, Treatment, and Prevention. The conference took place in Cape Town, South Africa, from July 19th through July 22nd, 2009.
I'd like to turn to Dr. Montaner.
Welcome, everybody, to this opening press conference. I'd like to highlight the importance for us of being in South Africa once again. As you know, in a historical sense, this conference is a follow-up of the earlier IAS initiative that brought the conference to Durban in the year 2000, one of the most successful conferences we ever had, which really opened the door for the rollout of antiretroviral therapy, what has become a very important priority in trying to control HIV, not just in this part of the world, but worldwide over. As you know, in recent years, we have become increasingly optimistic that with further rollout of antiretroviral therapy, we will make a difference on the life of people infected with HIV worldwide. And this is now particularly important as we have increasing data, more convincing data, that doing the right thing, offering treatment to people who need treatment, not only saves their lives, prolongs their lives, helps them to lead a near normal life, can eradicate vertical transmission of HIV from mother to child. But in addition to that, we know that role of antiretroviral therapy plays a critical role on decreasing HIV transmission at the community level. And because of that, it becomes a part of the essential ingredient of our combination approach to controlling the epidemic and ultimately conquering the epidemic. In that context, we are appalled by the recent GA meeting where there has been absolute silence when it comes to the ongoing commitment to HIV by the G8. As you know, in years past, the G8 had made a strong, clear, determined commitment to support the role of antiretroviral therapy, and this has had a dramatic impact, particularly in Africa. Our research team has recently demonstrated that as a result of the PEPFAR initiative, for example, there has been a significant decrease on HIV incidence, let alone the fact that there has been a decrease in mortality and morbidity, but also on HIV incidence in the worst affected countries of Africa. And yet, the G8 has dared to remain silent regarding their ongoing commitment to the role of antiretroviral therapy at a time when we are 1 year away from the deadline for universal access in 2010. We will not shut up on this issue. This is going to be a predominant theme this week, and we will make our G8 leadership accountable for the lack of action in this regard. This is not acceptable, and the IAS and our colleagues here in South Africa will speak loud and clear regarding this breach of their commitments. This is not acceptable. Thank you.
I'd like to turn now to the conference, local conference chair, Dr. Jerry Kuvadia.
So I'm going to speak mostly about the importance of this conference to this country. And I guess most of us know that conferences are the bane of scientists' lives, and there are just too many of them. So you have to justify why one should have an additional conference. And my purpose is to really say that this conference is almost the continuity, in a way, of a process that started in 2000. And many of you may not have been around in 2000. Julio has referred to the International AIDS Society conference in Durban in 2000. And by all accounts, it was a landmark event. It was a landmark event for many reasons. The first reason was that prior to that, the AIDS epidemic was raging fiercely in Africa and developing countries. The conferences were in the richer parts of the world. And it took imagination and courage of the people who organized the IAS at the time to bring it here. So it brought the conference right to the heart of the epidemic. And the heart of the epidemic, unfortunately, is in Southern Africa. So that was an important shift in the way the conferences and the priorities of conferences. And it followed naturally that the main gains of that conference were the local African, continental, and the other priorities of developing countries. So, for example, when we had that epidemic, the cost of antiretrovirals was beyond the horizon. I didn't even think of ever doing a research project on heart. It didn't exist in the realm of possibility. It was about $20,000 a year in the United States. Now, the cost is almost as cheap or cheaper than the treatment of diabetes or hypertension. That's how the cost came down. And in a multitude of ways, we brought the problems of the poor to the attention of the rich. And although one can't connect these things causally, the inflow of global funds, the philanthropic and bilateral and trilateral and multilateral funds which have flowed in, have been absolutely phenomenal. And I'm not only speaking about South Africa, I'm speaking about the whole of the developed world. Actually, billions of rands have come in from one source alone. Julio has referred to that. That's a PEPFAR grant. And much has come from the Global Fund, the World Bank, and so on. So it more or less started coincident with that. Not necessarily causally, but coincident with that. So it changed the nature of the way people in the developed world approach the developing world. But that's not my main purpose. It is an important part. The main purpose is to point out to the people who are attending, the journalists and the scientists, that they took a real important step in being there at that time. You may not remember, you may have forgotten, you may not know about it, but South Africa was going through a turbulent period. The schism between science and scientific progress and society was immense. I think, you know, there are rare exceptions I can think of in a modern democracy where such a gap existed because the state was manifestly, not the whole state, but part of the state as we learn now, supporting policies which were unscientific, believed in voodoo science and so on. And the scientists of the world and the journalists of the world supported us. There was a really notable declaration called the Durban Declaration. And in that declaration, many thousands of scientists and about 10 or so Nobel laureates spoke up and said, this is what science is. It wasn't attacking the government. This is what we believe. This is how we attain truth. That was a really important message because it forced the government at that time to begin to deal with the epidemic in a different way. Remember, they had objected to using drugs to prevent mother-to-child transmission, antiretroviral drugs, prevention measures. And there are some really interesting, shall we say, cultural, traditional, political factors behind those decisions, which are really outside the realms of the present discussion. But it all came to the fore. And the results of that, and what I'm going to end up with, is that we need the help again, or everyone's help again, because we're now at another type of threshold. The threshold we're standing in is we still have the worst epidemic in the world. And I'm not going to give you the litany of that because you can read about it, but the figures are still astonishing and still depressing. And what I want to say is that we as a country can deal with some of them, but we can't deal with all of them. We need your help to assist us in progressing more rapidly than we have done. And have we done well? We have. South Africa has. We had about 50,000 people at that time, soon after that conference on HIV/AIDS. We now have more than 10 times that number, 550,000 people on it. Prevention of mother-to-child almost didn't exist. It exists now for almost half the women who need it. And so on and so forth. There are civil society organizations like TAC and many others who are fighting this battle. We have got, for the first time that I've noticed, a reduction in HIV incidence in young people, 18 or thereabouts, teens, which is a promising sign. So we've got all these positive features, but they are the emerging signs of some progress. But we need help because now we have a new government and we have a new commitment. We have a deputy president who supported this. We have my colleague and friend, Aaron Mozzoledi, who is the Minister of Health. And these people are new in this field, and they are not against the scientific approach. So there's a time of hope, but that hope is difficult to realize because the disease itself is unique in the history of humankind, and we need your help and we need everyone's help to try and fight it as effectively as we can. That's what I want to say.
Thank you, Jerry. I'd like to turn to Vuyiseka Dubula now.
Thank you for coming here to this conference, and also for the journalists who have come around to also hear what we have to say tonight. For me, I think we are exactly 9 years after the Durban AIDS Conference, the International AIDS Society Conference, which was in Durban 9 years ago. And I think, as Dr. Kuvadia has said, that at that time it was a different era in South Africa politically, and in communities where we were seeing people dying of HIV with no hope of living because access to treatment was a dream. But I think for me tonight is to acknowledge some of the gains we've made in the past 9 years, that we are now celebrating the National Strategic Plan for the first time in South Africa, that we all agreed, civil society and government, that we need to have clear targets on how we're going to fight HIV in South Africa, where we're saying the National Strategic Plan is saying they want to reduce new infections by half, and they also want to treat people who should be on treatment, 80% they should be on treatment. Also, we are now enjoying the benefits of our long struggle on the prices of drugs, that now the prices of drugs are very cheap, and thanks to the availability of generic drugs. And that has direct results in the fact that we have saved about 3 million lives, including myself. And obviously, this is a small portion of a small percentage of people that are alive. 70% of people who should be accessing treatment are not accessing it now. But also, we also had the G8 countries in the international community who said they will support universal access to treatment by providing financial support to developing countries. Also, we had the Millennium Development Goals that were commissioned in 2001 that looked at three specific issues that are very important for South Africa and the region: maternal health, child health, and HIV, TB, and malaria, to stop HIV in the region. And I'm very sorry, I am going to be nasty tonight and actually paint the picture that we haven't achieved so much as we should have. But I am acknowledging that we have saved lives, but it's not enough. And I'm saying that in light of the fact that we have the economic recession. Now we have the international community telling us that, you know what, we're creating a burden to ourselves, that we're just going to continue pouring aid and pouring aid until Jesus comes. Unfortunately, they have broken that promise in 2005 by revising our universal access to treatment by saying we're not going to be able to treat 10 million people, we will be able to treat 5 million. So the more they revise their targets, that for me was an indication of lack of commitment. So therefore, they have broken their promise in 2005. This is not the time to use economic recession as an scapegoat. I'm very sorry. Part of the economic recession must include part of the economic recovery must include health recovery, because this is the time now when we need increased resources to achieve the MDGs and universal access, not less resources. And simply for me, the fact that now we are led to believe, as people live with HIV, we are led to believe that, you know what, you just have first-line regimen to live with. You're just going to extend your life for 5 years or 10 years. After that, forget about it, because PEPFAR is going to reduce its funding. Global Fund has a shortfall. And I'm sorry, we're not going to accept that. And for me, it's a strong message I'm sending to the international community. You committed yourself, and health is a global public health good, and it's a responsibility of each and everyone to commit themselves to what they have promised to people. We are waiting for those drugs. We are waiting for our health systems to be improved. We are waiting for maternal health to improve in my country. We're waiting for child health to improve in my country. This is not the time to say you're going to slow down your support or resources to Africa. And that's not the message I'm going to be taking to my community. The message I'm taking to my community is that we're going to continue to put pressure on every donors who have committed themselves in this struggle. We're not going to stop, and there will be no slowdowns, no to ARV stock outs, and any PEPFAR, including PEPFAR here, because they have already come out saying that they have budget cuts, they want to reduce their spending on health, and unfortunately, it's not something that's going to come down easily amongst people living with HIV. So we will fight it.
Thank you, Vuyiseka. I'd like to turn now to Stephen Lewis.
Thank you, Craig. I don't, as a rule, pay attention to titles, but I think the title of this particular opening speech, Scientists as Activists, says it all. I'm going to try to construct a relatively brief speech arguing that the scientists with the enormous authority which they have at their command should collectively be engaged in a number of the most crucial issues, not merely in the context of how accomplished they are in their knowledge, but in the context of the impact they can make on the world if they exercise their scientific authority. I'll, of course, deal with the funding and the astonishing delinquency on the part of the G8 around the flow of resources, but I also want to deal with some issues that aren't always part of the scientific context as activists, issues ranging from homophobia, vertical transmission known as a prevention of mother-to-child transmission, sexual violence, and I'm going to deliver what some will regard as a fairly scathing attack on the critics of AIDS exceptionalism, because I myself fed to the teeth with the way these critics are allowing G8 countries and others off the hook by making the totally specious and fatuous argument that AIDS is somehow taking money away from other health imperatives. So that will be largely the context of the speech this evening. Thank you, Craig.
Thank you very much, Stephen. Thank you, all the speakers. I think what you've heard is basically the themes of the conference, that since the International AIDS Conference was here 9 years ago in Durban, huge progress has been made after 18 years before that of utter neglect. How far we've come, but how far we have to go towards universal access to treatment and prevention. How the commitment of leaders may be waning, the promise that new science holds for the future. And really, this conference is about HIV science and the need for it to be rapidly implemented into the field. I'd like to open now for questions from the journalists.
Yeah, hi, Simeon Bennett from Bloomberg News. A question perhaps for Julio. Have you seen any evidence of the impact of the global financial crisis on responses to the epidemic here in Africa or anywhere else in the world? What's the nature of that of that impact been? And even now with the onset of the H1N1 pandemic, and I guess as the attention of governments and drug makers turns to the development of a pandemic vaccine, funds are going into that, attention is being drawn to that. Does that have an impact on the response to HIV, at least in the short term? Can you comment on those two things?
To wait for us to see an impact of the budgetary implications of the global crisis on the field would be a terrible mistake, because the damage that would be accrued by that time would be something that would be totally irreversible. We are fully aware of the fact, as Jerry was saying, that the biggest donors are having their budgets cut. And in fact, confidentially, some of the people in positions of power in some of those programs have indicated to us that more than simple reductions or freezing of the budgets, they fear for their survival. So we are very concerned, a lot more concerned than the data could be able to document for you here. These are not rumors. These are facts that have been transmitted to us by the mere people that are in position of control of those programs. And I'm not naming a program, I'm not naming a person, but the message that we're getting loud and clear is that the G8 leadership is not paying attention. And you don't have to go too far to see the evidence of that in the pathetic communique where there was no mention of their continued commitment to HIV. And you know, I realize people around this panel are trying to be polite and tell you that we have made a lot of progress. It continues to be so pathetic. We promised 3x5, and we never got to 3 million people on antiretroviral therapy by 2005. It took us yet another couple of years to get there. And now we had a commitment for universal access by 2010. And guess what? Universal access, according to guidelines that were current in 2001. The new guidelines actually have created a new gap that is double the number of people that were the deficit of people that are current treatment. So if we have, say, 3 to 4 million people on treatment, and there is a deficit of 6 to 7 million people that should be on treatment based on the old guidelines, there is another 4 to 5 million that should be on treatment already based on the new guidelines. And yet they are not saying, what are we going to do about it? Rebecca has told you, she is concerned about her life and the life of her peers because they have one regimen, maybe one line of treatment, and they have no backup. This is not acceptable. We need to bring the standard of care of antiretroviral therapy to what it should be in the rest of the world for one very simple reason, because we are on an economic crisis. And now you might say, well, Julio, you make no sense. Well, what happens is this. Our data has shown that by rolling out antiretroviral therapy, you decrease morbidity and you decrease mortality. That's fine. That would be the same as for any other disease out there. But the thing that changes the equation is that the treatment that would have been seen as a benefit for the person infected with HIV, let alone the fact that it has a societal benefit and so on and so forth, what it does, it has a magnifier effect on the prevention axis. And although we've been shy to say it, and there has been a lot of debate as to whether a person who is appropriately treated with antiretroviral therapy is non-infectious or less infectious or little infectious, let's get rid of that debate for a moment, and let's accept the fact that a person appropriately treated with antiretroviral therapy is way less infectious at the very least. So what happens is that by me treating this half of the room that is in need of treatment for their own benefit, I'm subtracting the pool of donors of HIV dramatically, and I'm decreasing the likelihood of transmission of HIV over there. So by treating more, we are actually making a cost-effective treatment into a cost-averting treatment. Now, when we first proposed this in 2006, people thought that we were a little bit loony. This was controversial, this was far out there. But as of this year, we have every major organization acknowledging this, including a paper by the WHO in the Lancet of all journals that verifies all of our claims. So let's stop the argument and let's admit that rollout antiretroviral therapy is highly effective, life-saving for those that are infected, and actually it's an essential part of controlling the epidemic. And it's being cost-averting, you want to make an investment during a time of crisis that actually is the smart investment. There are very few other things that we can do that are going to save us millions and billions and quadrillions down the road. So the time to invest in expansion antiretroviral therapy is now. And the silence from the G8 is not just pathetic, it's criminal.
Thank you, Julio. Next question, please.
Yes, Fred Scheich, IFARA TV. And I address this question to Stephen to really maybe make the case that Julio has stated so eloquently, and you're so eloquently able to state the case internationally. I'm wondering, is there some sort of a summit that could be arranged between government and science, who could state the obvious that we have just heard here, and also with industry, so they can all get together and really figure this thing out, and how we can make access make sense in front of them?
I'm not sure that I feel so presumptuous as to comment on a summit, and I don't know whether those things can be arranged. God knows there are, as Dr. Kavadia said, enough international meetings which deal with these things. But the fact that the G8 and the G20 and various other constellations have now refused directly to deal with the commitments that were made around universal access at Gleneagles in 2005 is a terrible commentary on what we may be approaching. And the consequences in death and human desolation know no limits, and they have to come to their senses. Now, one of the ways that we have in the past made governments come to their senses is when the scientific community itself moves in and puts tremendous pressure on using science as the fulcrum. And I'm going to make reference tonight to the work of the scientists way back who dealt with the Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists and the Pugwash conferences and the international prevention of nuclear war when the physicians were involved and won Nobel Prizes in the process because they forced government's hands. And I don't know whether that can be done through a summit. I don't know quite how it happens, but I do know that we're at a crisis point. I mean, Julio is extraordinarily forceful and eloquent on this, and I don't know how it can be better said that at the moment when you can begin to turn the pandemic around is precisely the moment when the G8 is in retreat, and that's crazy.
If I may add, this is the summit of scientists and health workers around the world that can make that loud and clear. Next year is the International AIDS Conference in Vienna, which is the summit of communities around the world, scientists, and global leaders. Following this press conference, there will be a march that Vuyaseka and TAC have organized that will culminate at the front of this conference center, where we will all go to receive a manifesto from the march addressing all of the issues that Julio, Jerry, Stephen, and Françoise have addressed, as well as Vuyaseka in their comments. Can we take another question? Sorry,
why
Julio.
You come to the microphone. You ask come. A very... No, come. No. You ask a very important question, and I'm going to turn it back to you. We count on you to make these headlines across the world and to make it clear that you got it, and we got it, they didn't, and you want an answer. Why are they not making the statements that they had to make? We have no other means to communicate these than through you people. We need your help. Jerry said we need everybody's help. We are talking about your ability to send the message loud and clear. The status quo is not acceptable. That lives are in danger. MSF is already talking about shortage medications. This is not the way to go. If you are going to have disruptions in the chain of treatment, provision of drugs, people are going to become sick. They're going to become more infectious. This is a crime. We cannot turn our back on the one thing that is working in the fight against HIV. We can turn around the epidemic, and any slowing down will be devastating for our effort.
Right. And the only thing I'm really caring about is that we really don't have enormous efforts from media saying these things and repeating the message that you've said. I try to do the best I can. We know we've had an interview with you and others, and Stephen Lewis is so eloquent. But I wish the message would get out more. We really do need that.
Thank you. There was another question.
My name is Ntantong Nguem with the IPS News Service. My question is directly referred to the lady from Turkey. You talked of your strong position regarding the donor community. My question is to you is, we have a situation whereby the donor community or the Western government, when they are releasing their funds to some of African government that we really know, when they give some strong conditions, even if the funding is directed to the HIV AIDS fighting and the health sectors, can you just try to give me some clue on this issue, especially if we look on the issue of Zimbabwe?
I'm not clear if I understood you. You are asking... say, for example, PEPFAR gives money to Zimbabwe. How are we going to make sure that the money that is given to Zimbabwe directly is going towards HIV programs on the ground? Is that your question?
My question is, we have a rhetoric that is very cool, that the Zimbabwean government usually says, it complains that when it is getting some funding from the Western government or the donor community, usually the funding is attached with the strict conditions, even if that funding is there for health services.
Well, I'm not sure, because I cannot generalize from a specific example. What I know is there were restrictions with some of the donors, in particular with PEPFAR. They have revised those restrictions. For example, there were restrictions in terms of which drug should be used. For example, PEPFAR used to be very strict that brand drugs needs to be used for the beneficiaries of the PEPFAR programs. Also, PEPFAR could not be used to treat sex workers. Those things have changed. They've started changing since 2000. Now, PEPFAR 67% or more of PEPFAR-funded programs are using generics. So I'm not sure if a particular example of donors who have given countries those restrictions. Because, for example, if in my country, in South Africa, there were those restrictions, we have to challenge them. As activists, as the media, anyone, we have to challenge them. We have challenged the PEPFAR program, and as a result, it has changed its restrictions. And I'm not definitely saying that it's the best program ever. PEPFAR is the best program, I mean, donor ever. Obviously, they have their challenges, and we have to challenge them as they come. But it cannot be used at the same time. Those examples of restrictions, they cannot be used as an excuse not to channel money in countries where it's needed. For example, in particular, Zimbabwe is at 32% of reaching universal access. And we just had a conference of 10 countries in the region. 10 countries are not going to meet their targets. They are not going to meet their targets. Already, Uganda is stockouts. We have heard in the past week that Uganda already, they are ARV stockouts. In South Africa, it's the order of the day. That you hear in Free State, we had in KwaZulu-Natal. There's another province coming soon. Formula Milk is not available for the PMTCT program. It's the order of the day. But this is not only the problem of the donor the aid money that is coming to countries. It's also a problem of our own governments that are not accountable, that are not budgeting and planning properly for the ARV programs. And obviously, we're not concerned about ARV program. We are concerned about the health system, the fact that the health system is not transforming to be able to cater for the majorities of people that need health care.
Jerry, I think you wanted to
add something to this. I can't speak with the eloquence of Julio or someone there. Anger that Stephen can on these sorts of occasions. But I just want to put some things into context. So I am as angry as anybody else about the fact that we've got these enormous funds, and I have seen the benefit they've brought, so no question about it. But I am worried it created more dependence than ever before, and I'm really concerned about the questions of sustainability. How do you transition from this, where some of our clinics are 70% dependent on external funds, to this period when we're going to afford it? And I'm more worried about the rest of Africa than South Africa. That's not the point I want to make. I'm as angry as that, but I'm not surprised at what is happening. Because as far as I remember, the struggle for freedom in this country was based on the fact that the Western countries never lived up to their promises. Why are you surprised? They never lived up to, what was it, Stephen, 0.75 or 0.8% of the GDP? 0.7%. And if I remember rightly, maybe one country at one point reached that, and the rest of the countries never did. We fought against trade imbalances. You forget? In 2000, we were fighting the World Trade Organization because the obscene World Trade Regulations, which resulted in those prices. And I can go on and on. That was what our fight was based on. We don't think we were just fighting the apartheid government. We were fighting all these supports. So in a way, I'm not making any excuses. I'm going to fight as hard as anybody else, but I'm not surprised.
Thanks, Jerry. We can take one final question, and I think it was the lady in blue.
Hello, my name is Yewande Iwoha. I'm from Lagos, Nigeria. I write for a radio station. Now, I want to take Dubula up on the question of accountability. On Thursday, we were with Treatment Action people at Fountains Hotel, and the bulk of the complaint was on accountability, that most of the time when these funds were made available, they were not actually, you know, used for what they were made available for. So I want to ask that if we are talking about G8, you know, for them to make more commitment to provide more funds. Now, how are we going to tackle the question of accountability to encourage the donor countries to give more to Africa? Thank you very much.
I'll tell you one thing we have tried to do in Africa. for the first time in Abuja 2001, we had all African states signing the Abuja Declaration. That was a major, major step forward for African state to say, I will treat my people 80%. I'm saying I'll put my foot down and I'll treat 80% of my people. That never happened in Africa before. The debate at that time was whether HIV does actually cause HIV. Let's not even entertain the issue of treatment. We have come a long way. And the reason why the Abuja Declaration is in place, it's because of the pressure of civil society and communities to say to our government, you need to treat your people. Now, the current condition where we are now, yes, we're not saying that because we're putting pressure on the international community, we're not going to keep pressure on our communities. What we are going to use as a tool as civil society, all the countries that have national strategic plans, those that have clear targets, most of the SADC countries have clear targets on what they want to, how many people they want to treat. We're going to use those documents and say, you have committed yourself to this document, you wanted to treat 50% people should be on treatment. Now, where are you? You need to be accountable. We need to be tracking the budgets, how much money is spent on health. And this is our responsibility to monitor whether the money is actually going towards health care, which is the responsibility of civil society, because we can't continue asking PEPFAR, Global Fund, to give money to countries. At the end of the day, the money does not end up to saving lives. And that's what we are committed to do.
The opinions expressed by hosts or interviewees in this podcast do not constitute professional advice, should not be considered substitutes for professional services, and do not necessarily represent the opinions of Body Health Resources Corporation or its sponsors. Please see the full disclaimer online at thebodypro.com. If you have comments or questions, please contact us.
Thank you for listening to this report from IAS 2009. For more coverage of this conference, please visit us online at thebodypro.com/IAS2009.